Today, it's a pleasure to have with us François Meynier. François, usually I present the speaker a bit to the audience. And François studied physics and then space science in Brussels and then Liège. He graduated in 2017 in Leiden in collaboration with a lab in Utrecht. And then you moved to Budapest, right, for a couple of years of the postdoc, I remember correctly. And now you are a research fellow at ESA at ESTEC, working on or in direction of Athena projects for your future. You're welcome. You can start whenever you want. Right. I invite people to interrupt François at any moment to ask questions, and or eventually use the chat. Okay.
Yes. Please. Thank you. Thank you very much. And of course, there's no problem. Feel free to interrupt me whenever you want. So, well, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Sadly, not physically with you, but at least on Zoom, and yeah, I hope I will use this opportunity to tell you more about the work I've been doing in the past year. So this is essentially the chemical enrichment in the intracrystal medium. So I'm going to explain you a little bit all of this. So just a little bit of an outline. First, I will introduce a bit the topic, and then we'll see basically four different aspects on the on this topic. So first we'll talk about the abundance ratios we have in galaxy clusters, how we measure them, etc. Then we'll talk about the spatial distribution of metals. We'll also talk about the trends of this enrichment with the mass of the system. So we'll talk about not only clusters, but galaxy groups and even giant elliptical galaxies. And then we'll talk about a little bit about the redshift evolution before going to the future missions. But first of all, let me just introduce a bit the topic. So as you all know, a few minutes after the Big Bang, we had what we call the primordial nucleosynthesis, in the sense that almost all the hydrogen and helium in the universe was created on that moment. But of course, that was essentially all, with a little bit of traces of lithium as well. But all the other heavy elements that we have today, you know, like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, etc., etc., were not present there. So we might actually wonder how and when they were created. And the short answer to this question is actually stars, and more particularly supernovae. So here it's important to distinguish two different cases of supernovae. So the first one is actually the core collapse supernovae, which are basically the ones that you might all think of immediately, almost. So, you know, these massive stars running out of hydrogen, so just starting to have this this onion-like structure where you have a combustion of different elements down to iron in the core, and then you don't have any more combustion afterwards because you start to have an endothermic process. And yeah, so basically at some point you just have a collapse of the upper layers onto the core, which will just bounce on the core, and then you just have violent ejection of all these layers with freshly produced elements, and that's what is a core collapse supernova. So here we talk about massive stars, of course. So these supernovae explode and enrich their surroundings quite fast after star formation, so a few million years at most. They produce mostly oxygen, neon, magnesium, a little bit of silicon and sulfur as well. So what I would call basically light metals here. And we might actually wonder how much of these elements are produced in proportion to each other. And this actually depends on different things. It depends mainly on the mass of the star. So the initial mass function, if you talk about an entire stellar population. It also depends on the initial metallicity of the star. So namely whether the massive star was previously enriched by a lot of generations of massive stars before. Or not. So this is what I would like to show you on this plot. So on this plot, you just see the different abundance ratios normalized to iron, which is here normalized to one, as a function of different nucleosynthesis models. you know, just taking into account different different initial metallicities, for example, as you can see here. And this is quite useful because it means that if you can actually measure the elements of all these elements in a given core collapse supernova, then you will be able to tell a bit more about its history. So basically, whether its initial metallicity was enriched or not, what is it in, its initial mass, etc. Then the second type of supernovae is, of course, the type 1a supernovae, which physically are completely different. So here we talk actually about a white dwarf, which somehow exploded as a thermonuclear bomb. We still don't know exactly yet how. So whether this is because of a merger with another white dwarf, or whether it's a result of a slow accretion with a main sequence companion. So mainly this is the double degenerate scenario versus the single degenerate scenario. But in any case, the time delay between the star formation and the type 1 explosion is much longer than for core collapse supernovae, simply because here we talk about low mass stars, which evolve more slowly. But of course, also because they are part of a binary system, of course. So it also needs to evolve by itself. In any case, we know that these type 1 supernovae produce more heavy elements. So typically from silicon, sulfur, up to iron and nickel. So essentially iron peak elements here. So how much of these elements are produced here again depends on some specificities, especially the physics of the explosion. So whether the burning flame of the supernova is always subsonic, which we call deflagration, or whether at some point this burning flame becomes supersonic, and then we call that delayed detonation. This may also depend on nature here of the progenitor, interestingly. So that's actually very useful because again, you can do the same exercise. So just take our best nucleosynthesis calculations for different models, which could be deflagration, delayed detonation, also either single or double degenerate, and then you just get different elements. So this is, for example, here for the nickel over iron ratio, where you have actually a deflagration, which produce more iron more nickel to iron than delayed detonation. So here again, if you just have, let's say, one type 1a supernova, then you can look at its elements, and then you can just say a bit more about the physics of its explosion. All right, so now let's completely change the topic. Let's just look at the larger scales of the universe. Namely the intracluster medium. So, you know, this when you have galaxy clusters, galaxy groups, and even elliptical galaxies, you have X-ray, hot X-ray emitting atmospheres around it, which is quite, which shines at 10 to 100 millions of Kelvin. So typically in the X-ray regime, so in emission. It's quite tenuous as well. It's optically thin, which is very good news because we can model it quite, quite easily. It's also heavily ionized, so you don't really have any, you know, radiative transfer effects, any complicated things here. So it's also very nice. And it also accounts for 80% of the total baryonic matter. So yeah, this is something, this is a very, very important component of our universe, especially if you want to understand how these large structures really form, grow, and evolve. And it turns out that actually this intracluster medium contains metals. This was first discovered actually in more than 40 years ago. With this this plot with the RL5 mission, where you can see here the first spectrum of the Perseus galaxy cluster, and you can see a bump here around 6-7 kV. And this actually corresponds to the K shell emission line of iron. So this was actually the first evidence that the gas is not made of primordial elements, but you know contains a lot of at least some iron. And of course, now we have much more modern missions, especially XM and Newton. And this is a typical spectrum you can get at moderate resolution with CCD instruments, where again you see here this emission line, this iron emission line. But you also see that we have access to another, to a lot of other heavily ionized lines here, so from oxygen to nickel. So this doesn't look really spectacular on this plot here, but if you start to stack a lot of these spectra and to remove the continuum, this is basically what you get here. And here you can already see all these lines that we can access. And that's quite amazing because again, these lines really tell you about the presence of these metals at the larger scales of our universe, which obviously all come from either type 1a or core collapse supernovae or a mix of both of them. And that's what we'd like to understand. If you zoom on this region, then here you have what we call the Iron L complex. It's not one single line, but it's actually a collection of a lot of lines, which unfortunately cannot be resolved by our instruments, at least not at moderate resolution. However, on XM Newton, you have a gratings instrument, which is called the RGS, which in some cases is able to resolve partially this complex here. You just need the source to be really, well, really narrow on the sky because it's a slitless instrument. At high resolution, we also have new types of mission now, which will be coming soon and which already came with Hitomi very shortly, however. And this is the use of microcalorimeters, which were really able to resolve this spectra with an exquisite spectral resolution here. So you can really see the lines well. If I just zoom here, for example, you can see here a comparison between what Hitomi can observe versus what you can get with a CCD resolution spectra here in red. So you can really see the huge improvement that we have here. All right, so let's come back to our metals in this intracluster medium. So the big question here is that we really want to understand all the chemical history of these large-scale structures. I mean, where, when, how they got chemically enriched. And for that, you can basically probe different aspects. Of course, you can look at the redshift evolution of these galaxy clusters if you want to have an idea on the chemical evolution. But this is quite complicated, as I'm going to show you. You can also look at the abundance ratios in nearby clusters that will tell you a lot about the source of this enrichment. You can look at the spatial distribution of metals in nearby systems. That will also tell you some clues about the history, as well as the comparison between not only galaxy clusters, but also galaxy groups and elliptical galaxies, as I'm going to show you a bit later. All right, so let's start first with the abundance ratios. So basically what we did during this past year is that we just took a sample of galaxy clusters, groups, and elliptical galaxies, which also have this hot X-ray emitting atmosphere there, which we call a shear sample. And I won't go into details, but this is essentially nearby systems for which we have excellent measurements on the lines, especially with RGS, but also at moderate resolution. So basically we have 44 systems. And with that, we were able to create this sort of abundance pattern, which is always normalized to iron. So all what you see here are just the oxygen over iron ratio, neon over iron, et cetera, et cetera. And so one is basically the solar level. So you see that actually all these ratios are actually quite close to solar, which is one here. Except perhaps nickel, a bit of chromium as well, which is slightly super solar, but this is already quite intriguing. And the amazing thing with this is that you can actually, if you just remember that this abundance pattern is the result of explosions of billions and billions of type 1A and core collapse supernovae, you can just take back our plots here and you can try to know more about the physics of this supernovae. So basically, what are the properties of the bulk of type 1A and core collapse supernovae that contributed to this enrichment? So the bulk of this type 1A, I would say, in the universe, actually. And then you can try to understand better whether there are, for example, delayed detonation or deflagration type 1A supernovae, or more like single or double degenerate and this kind of stuff. And same for core collapse. So you can just play a lot with these models, just take combination of one core collapse plus one type 1A, and always try to see what is your best fit. And this is basically what you can do here. So this is just an example. I won't go too much into details, but basically here the best combination, for example, indicates that for core collapse, you have a core collapse favor model in which you have some initial metallicity, which is non-zero. So we don't talk about population three stars, for example. We talk more about already enriched generations of massive stars. Delayed detonation explosion, so that's also quite interesting. And then you have a free parameter here, which is the type 1A over a total number of supernovae, which is here 38% more or less, which you could compare, for example, with the rates you have in our own Milky Way. But this was actually, old results, because they were done with a spectral code, which we used to fit the spectra and derive the abundances. So this spectral code was actually in a quite old version. And from 2016 to now, there has been a lot of new improvements here. And this is exactly the same plot as I showed you just now, just like in another style. In between there was also the Hitomi mission that was released, and Hitomi could basically look at the Perseus cluster, so not in a sample, full sample, but just one system. But thanks to its exquisite spectral resolution, just got better results. And actually, not only its good spectral resolution, but also the fact that the Hitomi collaboration just took advantage of a very new version of this spectral code here. And that changed quite a lot, as you can see. So now, for example, nickel is remarkably consistent with the solar value. So is manganese, so is chromium, etc. So you really have everything which is remarkably consistent to solar. This is actually the same from this this study, which just also uses the Hitomi values plus also RGS, so XM Newton RGS, again for Perseus. And motivated by this, we just wanted to see whether just taking our old data, so still with moderate spectral resolution, we would be able to reproduce them if we would just update our specs version, so from version 2 to version 3. So just change this spectral codes that we were using to fit our spectra. And indeed, that's the case. You can really see that, for example, here for nickel. So this is actually very good news, and this is very intriguing because it means that all these ratios are remarkably consistent with solar. So in other words, the chemical composition of the larger scales of the universe is remarkably similar to the chemical composition of our own sun. And this is still something that we are not really sure whether this is just a coincidence at this stage or whether this has a very physically deep meaning here. Something you can also do again with this this very good so this is exactly the same game as I showed you before, just with this new Hitomi results, and you can play again with a lot of combination of type 1a plus core collapse models here. But what you can see is that actually none of these models provide a satisfactory results. And one of the reasons is specifically the sulfur over argon ratio, which always seems to be over-predicted by the nucleosynthesis models. So here it's a bit difficult to say what happens. It's possible that actually there are some improvement needed in, basically for type 1a and core collapse nucleosynthesis models. It's also possible that we may have missed some bias in our measurements. It's quite difficult to say. All right, let's talk now about the spatial distribution of metals, and I will say rather the radial distribution, so from the center to the outskirts of typical clusters. So this is just a plot showing you the results for many of them. And what you can see is that you have a central increase towards the core, so you have more metals towards the core, which can be due to different things, but it can just be that the enriched material just tend to fall with the accretion, basically. But what is very interesting is that if you look in the outskirts, actually even to the virial radius, this metallicity does not drop to zero. Instead, it remains remarkably flat here, remarkably uniform even at large radius. And this is very important because at this large radius, you're actually probing the freshly accreted material. So in a sense, you're just looking back in the history of the accretion and the formation of clusters. And so this actually means that even this freshly accreted material was already enriched. So meaning that actually this enrichment happened quite early on. And this was actually confirmed by simulations, as you can see here. So in the blue line here, this actually shows a simulation where you have AGN feedback, which really helped to push the metals out of the galaxies. Actually, even before these galaxies were incorporated into clusters. So it's in this sense that we talk about an early enrichment, which happened before clusters and the intracluster medium got assembled. So mostly around redshift 2 or 3, mainly. AGN feedback really helped a lot here. While stellar feedback, which is shown here in red, stellar feedback alone could not entirely explain this. So yes, so we really have good evidence for this early enrichment. What you can also look at is the evolution of the chemical composition with radius. And if you just look at different ratios, for example, oxygen over iron also tells you typically the core collapse over type 1a projects and how they are distributed from the core to the outskirts. And you see that for all these elements, you find something remarkably flat also from the core to nearby the outskirts here. So you also have a uniform contribution of type 1A versus core collapse product across cluster scales, or uniform, chemical composition of the intracluster medium. This is also shown in this plot. This is almost exactly the same. The only difference is that here, for each spatial bin, we have been doing the same game as I showed you before, with type 1A plus core collapse models, just fitting all these abundance patterns per bin. And we just did that with two combinations of models. And here you see that indeed doesn't change anything from the core to the outskirts. So yeah, this type 1A fraction is remarkably the same. So this is also a very good indication towards the early enrichments, that all these metals were produced and well mixed actually before clusters started to form and grow. You can also look at the trend with mass. If you just look at ellipticals, well, basically you just have to remember that clusters grow hierarchically, which means from groups which themselves just grow from large massive galaxies, ellipticals. And that's the same for the intracluster medium we're talking here. So that's also interesting to have a comparison between the level of enrichment we have in clusters versus groups versus ellipticals. And this is what I would like to show you here. So this plot shows you iron, the central iron abundance versus the temperature, which is actually a good probe for the mass, in the sense that massive clusters are actually hot, very rich, and very hot gas, while group and ellipticals still have a cooler gas, which is just due to the shallower potential in which this gas falls. And what you can see is that basically clusters and groups, ellipticals, are enriched more or less at the same level here. Of course, there's a lot of scatter depending on the individual chemical history of each system, but you don't really see any trend. And this goes really, really in line with simulations, actually. Not only in terms of trends of the slope, but also in terms of normalization, which is really encouraging. You also see the same in terms of chemical composition. You don't have any change of the ratios from groups to clusters. And again, all this points towards this early enrichment, because if you just consider that groups grow and become clusters, the fact that groups today already have the same level of enrichment as clusters is really a good hint towards this, the fact that all these systems were already enriched before, well, at the time of formation. Here I just would like to show you some very preliminary results of a project I'm doing right now, which is about this elliptical galaxy just falling into this cluster here. You can also see a very nice ram pressure stripping tail here, really how this gas is just stripped. Basically you also get here for the iron abundance, you also get this central peak followed by some flatter profile here. And in terms of chemical composition, so abundance ratios, so magnesium over iron, silicon over iron, you kind of get something flat, although you see that this is not as, this can be a bit interpreted, it's a bit more difficult to interpret, to be honest. So here, I still need to see exactly what's going on, whether this might be just instrumental effects or whether this has a true physical meaning. All right, a few words about the redshift evolution, because I told you about this early enrichment. So now we really would like to probe whether we can have a direct evidence for that, whether if we just look at high redshift clusters, we can really see less enriched systems. And unfortunately, this is very difficult to say, because as you can see, the R bars are still very large. And this is simply because we don't have the necessary sensitivity in our instruments to collect enough X-ray photons to have good indications on their metallicities. You can still say something. So you can still see that here from redshift 0 to redshift 1, you don't have a significant hint for a change, for example. But of course, we also want to probe the at even higher redshift, right? We want to go to redshift 2 or even 3. So unfortunately, this is not possible to do that with the current instrument. But this will be possible in the future. And that's what I would like to shortly tell you in these last minutes. Let me first talk a bit about CRISM. So CRISM is a mission by JAXA, which is basically a reflux site of Hitomi. And in that sense, this is a very, very good news because Hitomi already has demonstrated all its power, in the sense that Hitomi just looked at the Perseus cluster and, you know, it basically produced like two Nature papers and it could really demonstrate how well we could basically take advantage of all this exquisite spectral resolution here to better probe the abundances. Maybe two key aspects here is that we'll have very good constraints on sodium and aluminium, thanks to CRISM. And these elements are extremely important if we want to probe the initial metallicities of core collapse progenitors. So we'll have very good indications on that. Also, we'll have very good constraints on manganese and nickel, which are extremely important to understand the explosion and also the nature of the progenitors of type 1A. So we might actually really help to solve that debate of whether type 1A supernovae are rather single degenerate, so, you know, just from this slow accretion with a main sequence companion, or whether they result from a violent merger with another core collapse supernovae. With another white dwarf. But the main, the game will definitely change with Athena. That will be definitely a revolution. Why? Well, because Athena has the same very excellent spectral resolution as Hitomi and CRISM, but it also has two orders of magnitudes higher effective area here, and one order of magnitude higher than what we have right now with XMM-Newton. Also, the spatial resolution will be very good, so it would be comparable to XMM-Newton, while for CRISM it will be a bit broader, unfortunately. And this will really, really help to probe high redshift clusters. So this is, for example, an example of what a cluster with redshift 1 will look like in the main instruments of Athena, which is the XIFU. Here you have this spectrum, this example of a spectrum you see compared to the previous and the current instruments actually. And you see that we won't be able only to probe iron, but also we'll have access to plethora of other elements here. So from oxygen to silicon and so forth. So this will really help to trace not only the chemical evolution of iron, but also of all these other elements. So the type 1A versus core collapse evolution of the at the universe scales, basically. These are also two plots to show you what you can do in terms of recovering all these abundances. So here what we did is that we just used simulations, cosmological simulations, which we actually from which we just injected some type 1A and core collapse models and AGB models. I didn't really mention that. And then we could actually measure this MOX spectra with Athena, and we were able to recover them really well. And then what you can do is just start to play with all these type 1A and core collapse models available in the literature and hope to find back the models that you were actually using in your input simulations. And this is actually this model in terms of reduced chi-square with our fit. So this is an excellent news because we are fully able to isolate the right input model, while you can safely exclude a lot of these models here. So yeah, Athena will be excellent. It will really be a revolution for that. But we need to be careful because we definitely need still ongoing improvements on the nucleosynthesis yields. As I told you, this is something quite quite important, and we're not sure yet. We definitely have the ultimate yields. And also atomic codes improvements are very important. As I showed you, different versions between the atomic codes might actually change your results. I won't go into details here because I don't have time, but this is basically an example of the current uncertainties you have between the two spectral codes that are the most widely used among the X-ray community. And you see that for some ratios, you have more than 10, 20% here. So, which is reasonable, but if we really want to go at the superb resolution of, the superb accuracy of Athena, we need to improve this. All right, so I will just finish with my take home messages. So basically what you have to remember is that metals are found not only, in the galactic scales, but also in the larger scales of the universe, actually between galaxies, in this intracluster medium. We have very good indications now that that we have an early enrichment that happened more than 10 billion years ago, so redshift 2 or 3, mainly thanks to aging feedback, which really pushed these metals away from galaxies before they were incorporated into clusters. And the best clues is basically that this chemical enrichment is remarkably uniform in many aspects, so system mass, abundance ratios, distance from the center as well. But we are still lacking some direct evidence. And for that, we'll definitely need the future missions. So CRISM as a first step, but Athena will definitely bring more answers. And I will stop here. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'll be super happy to take any questions.
Thank you, François, for this very, very nice talk to me. I see already a question by Sam. Samuel, please.
Hello, thank you for your very nice talk. I enjoyed it. I have a couple of questions, and one thing that I was wondering is what will be the result when you have the version 4 of the code, the spectral fitting? Because, and more seriously, what changed in the code that makes the result different? Is there some physics that has been changed, or is it why do you find something so different?
Yes, that's a very good question. Let me see. I might have some. Oh no, sorry. I thought I would have some additional slides, but I don't. No. So basically, the changes that you had between version 2 and 3. I will try to find. Yes, this was basically the plot. So the change you have between version 2 and version 3 was essentially on the number of lines that was actually calculated. And for example, the reason why nickel appeared so high here at moderate resolution is that there was actually one line which was not included, and because of that, you know, your fit really wanted to have to produce a higher nickel abundance to refit that well. So there has been a lot of changes between version 2 and 3 of this atomic code. So this has been a huge improvement. I don't think there will be much improvements on, well, maybe I will just, to answer quite accurately, I might just take this, this spectrum. Yeah. So I don't think you will have much more improvement on all this part of the spectrum. So all this iron K line here, nickel, etc., because here the physics is quite simple and we just start to know all the transitions, the atomic transitions really well. Where we are still missing a lot of improvements, however, is here, around this iron L complex, which is, you know, this region where you have a lot of lines, really bunch of lines, but a lot of them are not, they are actually not resolved. So we don't really know what's happening there. We have some good clues with our spectral codes, but CRISM will be very useful for that, because it will be able to resolve this this region really well. And then you can basically compare what you see with what your models provide. And then that will really help to improve the code. And in that sense, to be ready for even bigger missions like Athena. So it's a sort of iterative process that will obviously never end, but we always do much better than the previous step, every new step, if you know what I mean. So, yeah.
Thanks.
I think Alessia has a question. Please, Alessia.
Hi, thanks for the talk. I have a question regarding your distribution of metals in classes, for example, when you do it and interpret it, do you consider that there are other sources of metals injection, like, for example, in classes, ground pressure stripping can strip dust and these injects dust?
Yes, that's also a very good question. It's, you mentioned regarding this plot, right?
For example, yeah.
Yes, so basically, we don't really know, for example, what ram pressure stripping plays a role exactly. We know it must play a role, but there, sadly, I think there's only one or two papers about that, and those are quite old results. And they actually show that if ram pressure were playing a major role, you would have a different slope here. So you would have something a bit less peak, but something a bit more broad. But admittedly, these are all papers and we really need new simulations to probe this. So it's definitely possible that you have some other processes. But to be honest with you, for example, we still fail to completely understand why we have this central peak here. The the main interpretation right now is that at the center you have this you have this big dominant galaxy, right? This CD central dominant galaxy, which is red and dead. So it basically produces a lot of type 1a supernovae because you have a lot of low mass stars. And that could basically explain why you would have this this peak here. But if it's the case, then it means that this is something that happened actually after formation of cluster. And that should not include other elements such as, for example, oxygen or magnesium, which are more predominantly produced by core collapse supernovae. And if you remember, I think it's this plot. Here I basically showed that there's actually no change in any of this in any of these ratios. So you also have this central peak in oxygen, in magnesium as well. So in that case, this is honestly, this is still very difficult to explain why we have this central peak. I really hope that the simulations will help us to understand better. You know, like including a lot of processes like agent feedback, but also ramp pressure stripping, etc. But this is still a bit an ongoing question, to be honest.
Yeah, there are some recent studies that show that there is the stripping happening because of ramp pressure, and there is also the distribution of how dust is expected to go as function of the radius. But yeah, we can probably speak.
Is it like for individual galaxies, you mean, or is it for clusters? Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, I would be really interested to know about these papers, actually.
Okay. I'd probably write you. Okay, thanks.
Any other question or comment? I don't see any raised hand. Just a very marginal curiosity for me. For the when you estimate the radial profile of metallicity in clusters, I suppose that you're binning along the radial profile, right? So you measure, you estimate for the spectral metallicity for all the galaxies you have in a given cluster, then you bin in a radial.
Yes, exactly. So you have different ways of doing that. Of course, the mm-hmm. easiest way is just to look at concentric annuli from the core to the outskirts. Mm-hmm. But you're not necessarily forced to do that. I mean, with the CCD instrument, what you can do is just take any region of your choice. So instead, you can also create some metal maps, which I haven't shown here.
Okay.
They don't show you particular azimuthal distribution of metals. Except in some cases, which are very interesting, where you have very powerful radio jets, for example, coming from the central AGN, then you sometimes see that metals prefer to distribute along this jet. So it seems that here again, the AGN activity may help also to push the metals out even at present times. But yeah, for that you need to have like a very good very
imaging
deep exposures, of course. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other comment or question? I don't see no raised hand. In this case, thank you very much, François, again for your very nice talk. I remember to the participants that next week we will have a talk by Cyril Pitrou from IAP on Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the status of the deuterium abundance. As measured recently. So that's all. Thank